I can't find all the tests, but I just...
I was going to ask a question. If you wanted to find out if someone's age overlapped someone, or someone's lifespan overlapped another one, could you start with what it is that took Adam and took his age when his first children were born, and then just add the age of each, and the next one would have his son, how old he was. Mm-hmm. Is that the way you can do it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you came up with that. Noah and Abraham overlapped by like 60 years and things like that. Is that the way you would go?
Yeah, uh-huh. Would you do me a favor and erase these two boards? Could you get those for me? Thank you.
Well,
sure. Friend of Diane, Job, Carol Greger. Glad to know you, Carol. Well, I'm glad you have a chance to stop by.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoy yourself.
I forgot my name right here. All right, David. I don't mind.
Please turn to Genesis chapter 36, which is the offspring of Esau. Esau's offspring are listed in this chapter, and it's the last genealogy in the Bible for this man, Esau. God is through with Esau, in a sense, from this point and on. And the typology is that flesh and blood shall not inherit the kingdom of God. And so he gives this last genealogy of Esau, and then he continues to talk about Jacob, whose name will be changed to Israel, or has been changed to Israel. He's not through with Jacob, but he's through with Esau. There's a time when we will be through with the flesh, but Jacob will live on. Israel will live on. We will have that new inheritance with God. Now, Esau was also called Edom, E-D-O-M. And therefore, while we see no more about of the man Esau in the Bible, we do see his descendants in the Bible, the Edomites, are mentioned several places in the Bible, and usually in the context of being Israel's enemies, because we see the flesh and spirit conflict here like we have in File 8. For example, chapter 36, we have him in verses 1 and 43 mentioned, and then chapter 25, verse 30, Edom, we see that. One example of a mention elsewhere would be the book of Obadiah, which is... the smallest book in the Old Testament. It's only 21 verses long. It's one of the minor prophets. And the whole book contains only one prophecy. And that prophecy is against Edom. for what they have done to their brother, quote-unquote, Israel, because the nations are related, obviously, since they're descended from twin brothers. And for their fighting against Israel, God prophesies of the destruction of Edom in Obadiah. And several of the other prophets have prophecies about him, about Edom as well. Now, we come to chapter 37. Now, from chapter 37 through the end of the book of Genesis, through chapter 50, we have the offspring of Jacob. The offspring of Jacob, but centering in on only one of those offspring, namely Joseph, Jacob's 11th son, born to Rachel. Joseph was the firstborn son of Rachel. And Rachel was to have, of course, only one other son. And she would die in birth with him, and that would be Benjamin. Joseph was loved more than the other sons by his father Jacob. And as a result, we start off chapter 37 with a conflict. Joseph is hated by his brethren. They persecute him, just like they did the greater Joseph, Jesus Christ, hated by his brethren, persecuted by them. Jesus, you know, had half-brothers. Now, he was born of the Virgin Mary. So Mary had known no man when she had Joseph, Jesus. But after Jesus, then, of course, she had children by Joseph. And they would therefore be Jesus' half-brothers because they had the same mother, but they didn't have the same father because Jesus' father was God. Their father was Joseph. So they were half-brothers, just as these others that persecute Joseph are his half-brothers. And we see that Joseph brings an evil report to his father, Jacob. We're not told what that evil report is. In other words, we're not told exactly what was the bone of contention here, why they were persecuting him at this one particular time. But we see Joseph as probably the best and most complete type of Christ in the entire Bible. In well over 100 ways, Joseph points to Christ. Just as we see Jacob loving Joseph more than all the others, God said, "This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased." Matthew 3:17. And Joseph was the son of God's... I'm not going to give you all 100 types, so don't worry. Just as Joseph was born in Jacob's old age, he's born way up, as it were, at the end of time, the 11th son, so Jesus came at an appointed time, at the fullness of time, Galatians 4:4. And there's many, many, many other ways that he typifies Christ. For example, Jacob made for Joseph a coat of many colors. It's referring to a variegated colored robe that had threads that were dyed different colors, probably gold and purple and red and green and blue and white and maybe yellow. And then they were woven all together after they had been dyed these various colors, and a very beautiful, very costly garment. And he made one just for Joseph. And of course, this refers to the righteousness of Christ and all the attributes of God that came from him. Gold would show his deity. Blue would show the coming from heaven. Red would show the blood, the atonement. Purple is a mixture of blue, which is heaven, and red, which is the blood, showing royalty. He's the mediator between God and man. White would show his purity or righteousness. If the green was in there, now we're not told what colors are in Joseph's coat, so we can only speculate, but if green was in there, that can show either peace or mercy. There's some question on the typology of green, but peace or mercy, like in the 23rd Psalm, he maketh us to lie down by the green pastures, the Lord is our shepherd. See, that speaks of a time of peace and tranquility and perhaps mercy. So we see then a conflict, just as we've seen all the way through here, between Jacob and Esau, between Isaac and Ishmael, between Cain and Abel, between the serpent and the woman and the woman's seed, from the very beginning, the sons of God and the daughters of men. And then, God gave Joseph a dream. We're still in chapter 37. In fact, he gave him two dreams. And Joseph told these dreams to his brethren. And they involved Joseph being exalted. In one dream, there were sheaves laying in a field, and his sheaves stood upright, and their sheaves, meaning their bundles of wheat, bowed down to his. And in another dream, the sun and the moon and the stars paid obeisance to him. And the sun would be Jacob, the moon would be his mother Rachel, and the stars would be his brethren. So in both of those dreams, it seemed to be showing a subjection of his brethren, and in the other dream, even of his mother and father, to him. Well, you can imagine how that went over with his brethren when he told them that. They hated him yet the more, it says, when they heard his dreams. And so with the greater Joseph, he seemed like a dreamer to the Jews of his day. But all he was doing was being faithful to pass on to them what God had revealed to him. The Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the works. Whatsoever things I hear him say, I speak. Whatever I see him do, I do. All he was doing was passing on information that God had given them for their benefit. But they wouldn't receive it. So they hated him yet the more. There was nothing in his... You must keep in mind that there was nothing in Joseph's heart of pride in this. He was not seeking to exalt himself. These were not dreams that he concocted because he wanted to have power over his family. But they were dreams that God had given him because they were prophetic. They were prophetic of what would happen in later years. And he was being willing to just pass along this to his family. But these are his elder brothers. And they're saying, "What are you ruling over us, little brother?" He repeats these dreams. God gives him two dreams, even though he could have given the information just in one. But he does so for emphasis, to show the importance of it. And like I say, in one dream, it was the sheaves in the field, showing that the greater Joseph is sovereign over the earth, Christ over the field, over the earth. In the other one, we see the sun, moon, and stars paying obeisance to him, showing that Christ is sovereign in heaven as well. Every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess. He is over the things which are in the earth and under the earth and in heaven. He's given a name which is above every other name. So the exaltation of Christ is what is prophesied here, as well as just what we know it refers to, and that is that when Joseph will go down into Egypt and eventually be made prime minister, his brethren will come and bow to him and get grain from him, and his father will even come down, and they will end up living in Egypt, and Joseph will help them there. We know this is what the fulfillment will be in his life. But it didn't have a total fulfillment in his life. For example, his mother, Rachel, was never to go down to Egypt. She would die in childbirth with Benjamin while still in Canaan. And so even the prophetic part of the dream is unfulfilled in its totality in Joseph's life, showing all the more how we must apply it to Christ in its fullness and how it's speaking of him ultimately. So his brothers envied him, his brothers hated him, his brothers wanted to kill him, just as with the greater Joseph, Jesus Christ. And just as with anybody who will walk with God in our day, if you will be faithful to pass along the information that God gives to you, no matter how pure your heart and motives are, there will be some among your spiritual brethren in the church that will hate you because of it. And they will say, "Well, you're just trying to lift up yourself. You're just trying to lift up your church. You're just trying to exalt yourself." And you're saying, "No, brother, this is in the Word of God. You have a right to have that position too. God wants all of us to be overcomers." But they won't receive that. They'll just look at you and the information and they'll persecute you. So this has always been the way it has been. Even his father ended up rebuking him. Jacob even rebuked him when he told about the dream of the sun, moon, and stars. And the sun, Jacob realized, was himself. But he did have the wisdom to not go too far with his rebuke. And so it says, his father rebuked him, but he observed the saying. Kind of like Mary when she hid these things in her heart that the angel told her about the Christ child to be born from her. You know, she didn't understand it all at that time, but she kind of tucked it away in her heart about this one being the son of God and so forth. Well, Jacob, even though in the natural it was kind of hard pill to swallow, his son being over him and so forth, but it says his father observed this saying, meaning he kind of tucked it away to see, well, you know, Gamaliel approached, let's wait and see, this thing may very well be of God. Then, in chapter 37, we see that Joseph's brethren are out tending the flocks and herds of Jacob one certain day, and Jacob sends Joseph out to see how they're doing. Joseph was staying at home with Jacob for some reason, and Jacob sent Joseph out to check on his brethren. And this is what happened with the greater Joseph, Jesus Christ. The Father sent him out to help the brethren that were with the flock and to see how they were doing. Notice that the brethren are separated from their father. Christ came into his own and his own received him not, because they were separated from their father. Jesus said, you call yourself sons of Abraham, but you're really sons of the devil. They were separated out in the field, supposed to be tending the sheep. But Joseph was willing to go, and the greater Joseph was willing to go and to be obedient to that call. So he went out into the field to seek and save that which is lost. And he found them in Dothan. And it's interesting that this city of Dothan, where they were keeping the sheep, this name means law or custom. And that's exactly where Jesus found his brethren when he came. They were in law. They were in custom. They had rejected the commandments of God for the traditions of men. Bound and steeped in the laws of man and the traditions of man. So they saw Joseph coming, and as they saw him coming, they began to plot against him. They said, well, here comes this filthy dreamer, and they began to decide, we're going to have to do something with this guy. And Satan begins to lie to them, most probably, put things in their heart to kill him, and they actually decide that they want to kill their brother. That's how much hate the devil is able to build up in their hearts. And so, when he comes, finally gets to them to find out how they're doing, they strip him of that multicolored robe that his father had made for him. They hated that so much. And then they threw him in a pit. And they were going to kill him, except they were going to kill him, but then Reuben came along, the oldest son, and he said, let's throw him in this pit. And Reuben had it in mind to come back later and rescue him out of the pit from the brethren. Now you say, why? Probably because Reuben was the firstborn. Being the oldest son, he had more of a responsibility over his other brethren to make sure everything was okay. And so therefore he didn't want to see them kill Joseph, because he would be held responsible by his father Jacob. So he was just going to come and rescue him later. So they agreed, all right, we'll throw him in a pit. So they threw Joseph in this pit, and then Reuben went off to go tend the flocks or something, and the other brethren sat down next to the pit and had lunch. Can you imagine that? They sat down and ate while their brother was in this pit. And they were deciding, you know, what to do with him when all of a sudden a caravan comes across the highway of Ishmaelites trading balm and myrrh and going down into Egypt. And so Judah decides, instead of killing him, what profit is that? Why don't we sell him to this caravan as a slave, and they can sell him down into Egypt, and we'll get some money out of it. And so that's what they end up doing. They sell him for 20 shekels to this trade caravan, and off he goes. That's how he gets down into Egypt. So he doesn't get killed, but he does get sold into slavery. Then, of course, Reuben comes back later to the pit thinking to get Joseph out now and to free him, and he's gone because he's been sold to this caravan in the meantime. All of this represents what happened to Christ. The pit can represent Hades. He was stripped by his brethren, and he was cast into the pit, but he was eventually exalted in Egypt. That there you see the death, burial, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ in type. And then it says that Joseph is sold, the trade caravan. The caravan made some money on it, I'm sure. In fact, the price of a slave apparently was 30 pieces of silver at this time. And they picked him up for 20, and so they would sell him for 30 in Egypt, most probably, and make 10 pieces of silver on the deal. And it says that they sold Joseph to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. So now Joseph finds himself being a slave to the captain of Pharaoh's guard, an officer by the name of Potiphar, and he's down in Egypt. Now, chapter 38 is kind of an interlude in the story of Joseph, because it does not deal with Joseph, it deals with Judah and his family. So here we have a little brief incident concerning one of the other 12 sons of Jacob. And after this chapter, it'll flip back immediately, right back to where we left off in the story of Joseph. But it talks about the fact that Judah married a Canaanite woman, and he had sons by this woman. Of course, that was a mistake, wasn't it, intermarrying with the people of the land. He had three sons, Onan, and Shelah, in that order. And apparently was a wicked man, so wicked that God had to slay him, and he died without having had any sons. And he left his wife a widow with no sons to carry on the name and the heritage and the inheritance. And so Jacob gave his second son Onan to the widow of his first son so that he might raise up seed and offspring to his name. But the second son refused to do that, and therefore he was slain by the Lord as well. So it doesn't say too much about the spirituality of his sons, most probably because of the influence of their Canaanite mother, as I say. So now we've still got this widow of with no sons, and there's only one son of Judah left. But he's too young to marry her. He's too young right now, but Judah promises that when he gets old enough, he will give her to husband so that she can have a seed to continue the name of her deceased husband and to continue to have an inheritance. But apparently, Judah reneges on that promise because Shelah apparently comes of age and he never gives him to this woman, Tamar. And so Tamar begins to take things into her own hands. And she ends up dressing up like a harlot, deceives Judah. He has intercourse with her. She becomes pregnant, and then Judah, when he goes back home, news eventually comes to him that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant. Well, he has no idea that was the harlot that he had relations with several months earlier, because I say she disguised herself. So he says, well, she's become pregnant, and she didn't wait for, my son Shelah to take her to husband, and so let her be burned or stoned, one or the other. I can't remember which one it was. And then she produces Judah's staff, Judah's garment, and Judah's signet ring, which she as the harlot had taken for her wages. And now he's able to find out, 2 + 2 = 4, this was the woman that he had relations with, and he is the one that's guilty in the matter. So he was not able to, bring any kind of judgment on her or anything. Now that doesn't say too much about Judah's spirituality either, does it? The Bible doesn't whitewash people. It shows them just like they are. Just like they are. So what happens? She bears sons, twins, Phares and Zerah. And Phares is in the line of Christ. Christ will come through the line of Phares. Now, why is this chapter in the Bible? It might seem like it's an interruption in the story of Joseph. It seems like an unnecessary showing of their sins and everything else. Well, one thing it's showing is that out of weakness, God can bring strength. Because out of kind of a dark episode like this, something, you know, it sounds like it came out of a soap opera on daytime television or something, that out of even an incident like this, God can bring good, because Christ would come from that lineage. See, out of weakness, strength can come. It shows also the problem of intermarrying with the Canaanites, because remember, it was a Canaanite woman that Judah took. And also it's in here to show us part of the lineage of Christ. Did everybody sign the roll book? Okay. Yes. Daughter-in-law.
Was that the daughter of one of his brothers?
No, it was the wife of his first son.
Oh, what kind of woman was she?
I believe she was a Canaanite also.
Yeah. So Jesus came from the line that was outside of the Hebrew funeral.
There were Canaanites involved in the ancestry. But remember, the lineage is reckoned according to the man, not according to the woman. Okay, the blood comes from the, you know, the line of the father, not the mother. And so Judah, it came from Judah, see. And so regardless of what the woman was involved, it comes from the male lineage right on down. Okay? All right, now we get back to chapter 39. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back at Egypt, we see that even though Joseph finds himself in a strange land, Egypt, as a slave to this guard, captain of the guard of Pharaoh's palace, that God's blessing is upon him. God blesses him so much that this man, Potiphar, gives him quite a bit of responsibility, quite a bit of authority in his household. But the devil's not through with Joseph yet. The devil's still trying to get this man, just like he's still trying to get all of us. You have victories, but victories are often followed. On the heels of victory comes another trial sometimes, another temptation. The devil will be battling us until we finally overcome him through Christ. And so what happens to him now is that while he's working in the house of Potiphar one day, Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. And he keeps saying no. In fact, she does tries this every day. And every day he says no. And one day, she finally catches him totally alone in the house. It's just her and him. She grabs him again and says, "Lie with me." And he says, "No, how could I sin against my master who's been good to me?" Because that would be, you know, sinning against her husband to do that. And against God. Showing you that this man has supreme moral integrity before God. And she caught him by his cloak or outer garment, and he fled. He fled out of that room. He figured this is time to turn and run. You know, the dialogue isn't getting me anywhere. It's not any good to reason with this woman. I better get out of here. And so he flees, but she's got a hold of his outer cloak, and it ends up in her hand as he flees the place. And so then her pride is stung now, of course. Her ego is smarting. And so she cries rape, you know, one of the age-old cries of a woman who has been, pride has been wounded. But she's got proof, quote unquote. His garment, right here. This man came in and tried to abuse me, and he left his garment right here in the bedroom. And so she accuses him, and therefore his master, Potiphar, throws him down into prison. Falsely accused. Again, we see the greater Joseph, Jesus Christ. Falsely accused. Accused of something he did not do and judged for it. It doesn't say too much for Potiphar here that he didn't even bother. Apparently, he didn't even interview Joseph on this matter and try to get his side of the story. He just listened to his wife, and that's all it took for him. He had his evidence, his proof, you know, showing you how much proof can be sometimes, how little, you know, how something can look like proof and not be proof at all. But that's all it took for that guy, and so Joseph finds himself in prison now. But even in prison, you think, my, this guy is down on the canvas finally for the 10 count, but God's blessing is still upon him. Because even in prison, God blesses this man so much so that the the prison keeper, the prison guard, puts all the other prisoners under Joseph's authority. So no matter where this man is, he's got such integrity, such ability, such honesty, intelligence, and so forth, that everywhere he goes, the blessing of God is upon him. So now he's placed over all the other prisoners in prison. And of course, this can speak of Christ in the prison house when he was in the heart of the earth. And then two people get in trouble in Pharaoh's court and get thrown into prison while Joseph is there. The butler and the baker of Pharaoh. The butler is actually this is chapter 40 now. The butler is actually the cupbearer in the Hebrew. And it's a very high, honored position in the court of Pharaoh. And the baker would be the chief chef, and that was also a very high position. But these two men did something to offend Pharaoh, therefore he threw them both into prison. And while they're in prison, they have dreams. Dreams that are deeply symbolic. And the next day after they have these dreams, they're troubled because they don't know what the interpretation of these dreams is. And Joseph, remember, he's in charge of the prisoners, and he sees that these two prisoners are having some troubles. So he asks them what the problem is, and they tell him that dream. And basically, the interpretation is that in 3 days, the butler will be restored to his position as Pharaoh's cupbearer. He will be let loose out of prison and restored to his position again. So then the baker says, boy, that sounds good. So the baker tells Joseph his dream. And Joseph gives the interpretation, and the dream there is that in 3 days, the baker is going to lose his head. He's going to be executed in 3 days. So his dream didn't come out quite as good as the other ones. And so they had a very easy way to test whether he was telling the truth or not. Just wait 3 days. And sure enough, 3 days later, the cupbearer is let loose out of prison and is restored to the court of Pharaoh, and the baker is executed by Pharaoh. But the sad part of the story is, besides, you know, nobody wants to see somebody lose their head, but perhaps he deserved it. But the sad part of it is that once he got back into the court of Pharaoh, the butler forgot all about the fact that it was Joseph that had interpreted that dream, because Joseph had told him, now look, when you get out of prison, according to the interpretation I've given you, remember me. In other words, help me get out of this place, seeing as how I've helped you. Well, he doesn't remember him. And so like many other people that have been incarcerated through the ages of time, they find out who their real friends are, who's willing to visit him, who isn't, who's willing to help him, who isn't. And so this man forgets him because now he's back in good graces with Pharaoh. And so Joseph remains in prison, I believe, another 2 years in prison. They talk about a trial. Can you imagine that? A 2-year trial down there in prison. And yet he's not grumbling, mumbling, complaining, and doubting God. He's just continuing to walk with God. Now we come to chapter 41. Everybody seems to be dreaming all over the place here because Pharaoh receives a dream. Of course, all of these were given by God, weren't they, for specific purposes. Pharaoh dreams a dream. And in his dream, actually, two dreams. In the first dream, 7 healthy cows come up out of the Nile River and stand upon the bank. 7 skinny, lean cows come up out of the Nile River after them and swallow up the 7 fat, healthy cows. They just eat them right up. And he wakes up, troubled. Then he goes back to sleep again, and he has another dream. And in the second dream, there are 7 beautiful, healthy stalks of grain. And then after that are 7 lean and thin ears of grain that devour the full ears of grain. And he wakes up again, And he's troubled because he doesn't know what this means. You know, he knows that this is of the Lord. This has some meaning about his life or the land or something, but he doesn't know what. And so the next morning he gets up and he's troubled. And he gets all his wise men and his magicians and his soothsayers. They can't come up with any kind of interpretation at all. In fact, God probably withheld their understanding so that they couldn't even concoct any sort of a, you know, made-up interpretation for it. And then, all of a sudden, wouldn't you know, boom, the butler remembers. Wait a minute, what about that Hebrew slave down in the prison there? Joseph, I think his name was. He interpreted my dream and the baker's dream, and they came true. And so he told Pharaoh about Joseph. And Pharaoh says, well, get him up here. Let's see if he can help us. So they go down into the prison, clean up Joseph, bring him up before Pharaoh. Pharaoh tells him the dreams, and then Joseph interprets the dream. Again, God's anointing is upon his life so that God gives him the interpretation to these two dreams. And the first thing he tells Pharaoh is that even though there's two dreams, they're just one dream because the meaning is one. It's been doubled in order to show the emphasis, and that it will surely come to pass. You know, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, let every word be confirmed. So, the dream, quite simply, is telling Pharaoh that there are coming 7 years of plenty upon the land of Egypt. 7 years where they will have great, abundant harvests. But that will be followed by 7 years of terrible, terrible famine. And so the fat cow and cows and the fat grain stood for the 7 years of plenty, and the skinny cows and the skinny grain stood for the 7 years of famine, which was to follow. And then Pharaoh says he feels that is the correct interpretation, but then he says, well, what are we going to do? And Joseph said, well, you better set some wise men over the land to direct your affairs so that you can survive through the 7 years of famine that will follow the 7 years of plenty. And Pharaoh begins to scratch his head and think, boy, who can we set over the land? Who's a wise man, able to direct the affairs of our land in a time like that? And then he realized the man is standing right next to him. If Joseph has got that kind of wisdom and understanding to interpret the dreams, well, why don't we put you over the land? You're the perfect candidate. And so he does. And so Joseph becomes second only to Pharaoh in the whole land of Egypt in power and authority. Pharaoh gives him his signet ring, puts the royal robes on him, puts him in the chariot to ride second behind the chariot of Pharaoh throughout the land and have everybody bow the knee to Joseph. And so that dream is on its way of being fulfilled, those two dreams that God gave him for his brethren. It's on the way, and this is the exaltation of Christ. God has given him a name above every other name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow. So Joseph becomes second only to Pharaoh. Many people have called him prime minister for lack of a better, better title. And he's given a wife, and he takes an Egyptian wife, and he bears two sons. The first son, Manasseh, the second son, Ephraim. Manasseh means forgetting. For God has made me to forget all my troubles now that I am being blessed in Egypt. And Ephraim means fruitful. For, said Joseph, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And the dream begins to be fulfilled that God gave Pharaoh. The 7 years of plenty come, and while they harvest, during the harvest of the years of plenty, Joseph has them take, I think, a fifth or 20% of all of their harvest and lay it aside in granaries and store it against the time of famine which is to come. And so he's using wisdom in the affairs of Egypt. And then after the 7 years of plenty, the 7 years of famine come. And they turn out to be famine, not just on the nation of Egypt, but all the nations round about that area. It's just a general widespread famine. And so as a result, people from other nations are coming down to Egypt to buy grain because now they still have grain because they've been wise enough to store it up during the time of plenty. And so now they're able to not only support themselves, but to even still have some to sell to the others. It calls it corn, but it's probably most probably referring to wheat and not what we call, you know, the corn, like corn on the cob, Indian corn. It's more likely wheat or grain. All right, that leads us to chapter 42 to get back to Jacob and his other sons. Jacob and his... See, what has he got now? 10 sons with him? Because Benjamin's born now. He's got 11. And Joseph is down in Egypt. Right, Benjamin's born. So Jacob and his 11 sons finally run out of food and provisions there in Canaan, where they're staying. So Jacob sends 10 of his sons down to Egypt to buy grain, because they heard that Egypt did have a surplus and was selling it on the market. The only one that he didn't send was Benjamin. And pretty obvious reasons there, because Benjamin was the only one left from his true love, Rachel. Rachel only had the two, Joseph and Benjamin. And Joseph is gone, as far as Jacob is concerned, because when the brethren, and I didn't tell you this, but I'm telling you now, when the brethren came back to their father Jacob after selling Joseph into slavery, they sprinkled goat's blood on his garment, and they came back and told their father that they had found Joseph's garment spotted with blood out in the wilderness, and they didn't know what happened to him. And so Jacob supposed that an animal slew Joseph. And so all this time, Jacob is believing that Joseph has been slain by a wild animal. His brethren had to lie to their father and cover up this whole plot where they had sold him into slavery. So he's lost Joseph, as far as he knows. And now he's only got one son left from his true love, Rachel, and that's Benjamin. So little Benjamin, the youngest, he keeps home with him. And he sends the other 10 sons down to buy grain in Egypt. So the 10 brothers come, and who do they have to bow down to in Egypt and buy grain from? But that's right, you guessed it, Joseph. And here comes the dream. And remember, the sheaves were in the field, and their sheaves bowed down and paid obeisance to his sheaf. It was simply prophetic of the fact that God would exalt Joseph and put him in a place where he could help his brothers during this time of famine. So Joseph recognizes his brothers. Now, it's been many, many years, because he was only 17 years old when they sold him to the caravan to go down to Egypt. And he was 30 when he was made prime minister of Egypt. So what's that? 13 years? So it's but the 7 years of famine of plenty have been over since he's been made prime minister. So you've got 13 plus 7, so it's been about 20 years. At least 20 years since he's seen his brethren. He's around 37 years old now, and he was 17 when they sold him into slavery. But he recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. Now you say, well, how come they don't recognize him? Well, he was only 17 years old, and a man undergoes quite a few physical changes from adolescence to adulthood, from 17 to 37. Besides that, he's got Egyptian clothes on now. He's speaking the Egyptian language of the day. His head and beard are most probably shaved, because the Egyptians did not wear beards, and a lot of times they had their head shaved. And he may have some sort of a head garment, maybe a headdress on of some sort, and he's sitting in royal robes, probably on a throne, speaking Egyptian, and so they would not, and he would have had a beard before, and longer hair, or at least some hair, and so forth. And so they don't recognize him. He recognizes them. And they come before him to buy bread. And when they come before him to buy grain, he says, no, you're not coming into this land to buy grain. You're spies. And you're coming just to spy out the land so that you can go back to your king and tell him about the vulnerability of the land, and then come and take it over. And they said, no, we're not spies. We're sons. We're the sons of one man who lives in Canaan, who sent us to buy grain. And Joseph says, no, you're spies. I know it. Now, why is he putting him through all that? The reason he's not putting him through it is because he's getting back. He's got all this bitterness and critical spirit. You know, for all these years, he's held a grudge against them for what they did, and now he's getting back. That's not the reason he's doing it. He is led by God in what he is doing. And the reason he is doing it is because he's seeking to humble them before the Lord. He's seeking to do something that will cause them to remember what they did to Joseph and to repent of that, so that they can begin to have a right relationship with him when he will show his identity to them and to God and be one again. So this is why he's doing this. So Joseph says, all right, if you're not spies, prove it. How are they going to prove it? Well, you leave one of your brothers here in prison. And because they said, we are the sons of one man, and there's two other sons, one is not, and the other one is back in Canaan. And so he says, all right, let's see if that's just a phony story that you concocted in order to get off the hook, or whether it's true or not. You say you've got another brother, and of course they said one is not, and he was standing right in front of them there. But and they knew better too. They probably felt bad when they said that, because they had to lie again, because they knew that Joseph was probably somewhere in Egypt, you know, as a slave to somebody, or if he was even still alive. So he said, all right, I'll prove it. You leave one son here for collateral, one of your brothers here in prison, so you'll come back. And you go back to Canaan, and you bring this other brother back that you say you've got. So they leave Simeon in prison in Egypt, and they have to go all the way back to Canaan and get the youngest brother, Benjamin. And all this time, the brothers are talking among themselves. What's going on? You know, why is all this happening to us? And they're feeling guilty about what they've done to Joseph, and they're saying, that's got to be the reason we're going through all this. God is punishing us for what we did to Joseph. So they're beginning to, you know, feel a remorse for what they did. They're beginning to feel a change of heart. So the nine brothers return to Jacob, and they tell the story to him. But Jacob says, no, you're not going to take Benjamin. You've already bereaved me, or I have already been bereaved of my son Joseph. And I'm not going to let you take Benjamin too. That's the only other one I've got of Rachel. So even though he knew Simeon was going to sit there in prison in Egypt, he said, you're not going to take Benjamin too. So it was a Mexican standoff, as they say. They had to just kind of stay in Canaan and eat the grain that they had purchased from Egypt. And that's where chapter 42 ends. Now, Joseph probably had an ulterior motive also why he wanted them to go get Benjamin and bring him, because Benjamin was his only full brother. And his little brother Ben, he hadn't seen him for over 20 years. He probably wanted to see him again, so he figured this is a good way to get him back here. Plus, to see if they're going to be willing to obey. Now we come to chapter 43. The plot thickens. Because they've eaten all the grain that they acquired from the first trip, and they know that sooner or later they're going to have to go back down there to Egypt and deal with that hard prime minister again and try to get some more grain. They probably could use some more brain too. But they remember what Joseph's last words were to them. You shall not see my face again unless you bring your younger brother. In other words, don't bother coming into this court again unless you bring that younger one to prove that you're not spies. But Daddy Jacob won't let him take Benjamin, so they feel like they're between a rock and a hard spot here, because he told them, go back and buy grain for us. But they can't go back without taking Benjamin back. So finally, Jacob yields and says, all right, take Benjamin. And if he dies, he dies. If I'm bereaved of him, I'm bereaved of him. I'm going to have to let him go. And his son Judah promises to be a guarantee or a surety for Benjamin. He says, look, I'm putting my life on the line. And if anything happens to Benjamin, then you take my life. You know, you take it out in my hide, so to speak. And we'll see that God greatly blesses Judah for this. In chapter 49, there's a great blessing upon the nation of Judah. And of course, Christ is to come from Judah. So the brothers arise and they take Benjamin, and they go back down to Egypt again. And this time they bring double money for the grain, because Joseph really threw him a curve. He took all the money that they had brought to pay for the grain the first time, and he had his servants put it back in the sacks that were full of grain, so that when they got home and opened up their sacks of grain, they found the money back in it that they had given to him to pay for the grain. And they figured, is this guy trying to frame us? You know, is this a frame up to get us all in prison or what? So they bring double money for the grain, and they come to Joseph, and he invites them over to his house to dine with him. And the first thing he does is he seats them around this table in order of birthright. I mean, in order of age, in order of birth, I should say. All because he knows, you know, who his brothers are and what their ages are. But that kind of baffles them. Because you take any 10 men, and actually it's 11 men now, isn't it? Any 11 men, because they got Benjamin with them, and put them together, and if their ages, some of them are kind of close, you're not necessarily going to be able to seat them all down right in perfect order of age. Some men look younger than they are, other men look older than they are. He sits them right down, and boom, 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 like that, around the table in order of age. He's almost playing mind games with them about this time, but again, he's not trying to mess them up. He's just trying to, you know, get him to realize the Lord is in this thing. God is working somehow and trying to bring him to a place of repentance for what they've done. And then he feeds them a nice meal, but he happens to have such a heart for Benjamin when he sees him again that he gives Benjamin five times more food and five times more clothes and everything else than the other brethren. He really loads them down. And then in chapter 44... Joseph attempts to keep Benjamin there in Egypt. What he does is this. He gives them all their grain that they've purchased, and then he sends them away. But Joseph takes his own special silver drinking cup with his insignia on it, and he has the servant that fills their sacks with grain hide it in Benjamin's sack. Okay? And when they get out of town and they're on their way back to Canaan, he sends some of his men after him to catch up with him and say, "Wait a minute. You dined in the house of my master and you've got the gall to take away this cup, which is his special cup and by which he divines, you know, because the Egyptians divine, not that Joseph did, but just to, you know, make the story sound plausible." And the brethren say, "What are you talking about? You know, whoever sack you find that cup, you know, let him die and let us be your servants. We have taken nothing. We're honest." And so they search all the sacks and they open up Benjamin's sack last, and there it is, right inside the mouth of the sack, the silver cup. And by this time they wonder, what? You know, God is really punishing us for what we've done to Joseph. So back on their donkeys and back into Egypt again to Joseph. And he attempts to keep Benjamin and send all the other brothers back to Jacob. He says, "Look, you just let me keep this one brother and you can all go back to your father in Canaan." But they don't want to do that, especially Judah, because if you remember, Judah has made himself surety for his brother Benjamin, and so he intercedes for him. And Judah gives a long and touching story, and he just tells, totally honestly, above board, the whole story of everything about how they've gone back to their father and they had to convince their father in order to let go of Benjamin and that he would be surety for him. And now if they go back without Benjamin, their father will, you know, die of a broken heart and so forth. And Judah's speech shows his heart for the Lord and shows that his God has worked on his heart, especially since the time when he was the one that said, "Let's sell him to these, you know, slave traders down into Egypt and get some money for them." So see, God has been changing, working on their hearts. Alright, that leads us into chapter 45. And in chapter 45, Joseph can contain himself no longer. He finally reveals his true identity. He sends all the Egyptians out of the room, and then he reveals himself. He probably starts speaking in the Hebrew tongue now, instead of, you know, Coptic or whatever the Egyptian language was he was speaking. And he says, "I am your brother. I am Joseph. I'm still alive." And rather than tears of joy and laughter of gladness, his brethren are troubled at his presence. When they find out that that's Joseph, they're super troubled. And you would think they wouldn't be. But they are. The reason why they are is because they fear retribution. They're judging him what they would do in that situation, because what they would probably do is want revenge. See, now I've got you, you know. Now I'm going to put you on the rack, and you know you're going to suffer a slow death for what you did to me. And they probably feel that's what Joseph is going to do to them, and so they're troubled at his presence. But Joseph tells them, "Don't fear. Even though you wanted to slay me, God meant it for good. God was able to bring good out of it." And so he tells the whole story, how he ended up in Egypt and how God has been with him. And there's weeping and embracing between all the brethren, a happy reunion. And Pharaoh's house even hears about it and rejoices with him. And Pharaoh gives him, and Joseph tells him, "These are my brethren." And Pharaoh gives him all kinds of provision to return back to Canaan and bring Jacob with him, back down into Egypt. Why live in Canaan now? Now that you know that your son is alive in Egypt and there's still famine in Canaan, I've got all you need. I can take care of you and set you up perfect here in Egypt. So he sends him back fully laden with provisions to go back to Jacob and to bring him back into Egypt to see Joseph. So all the 11 brothers return to Canaan, and they come back to their father Jacob, and they tell him the whole story. And at first he can't even believe it. It's just too fantastic a story to be true. But finally he does believe it. So in chapter 46, Jacob and Joseph are reunited as they come back to Egypt. And here we have the fulfillment of that dream. The sun, moon, and stars paying obeisance to him. Now his father is even under him. Not in a family sense so much, but in the sense of him being under Pharaoh and over all the people of the land, except for Pharaoh himself. And so there's that exaltation of Joseph that the Lord had prophesied through those two dreams, now being fulfilled. In chapter 46, God again reaffirms his covenant with Jacob. And Jacob and his sons, actually, before they go into Egypt, they gather up all the people of their household and all their goods, and they move down into Egypt. And at that point, a list of all of his sons and of his grandsons are given. And then Jacob and Joseph meet again, and there's a touching scene there. And in chapter 47, Joseph presents his family before Pharaoh and introduces them to them. And Pharaoh seems to be very, very generous and very happy to see Joseph reunited with his family. And Jacob's and Joseph and Pharaoh gives them the land of Goshen to live in, which is a very fine pasture land in the Nile Delta region of Egypt. Up in here. This is Goshen, right up in this area here. And Jacob blesses Pharaoh, and he kind of testifies a little bit about the Lord and how the Lord has been in his life. And thus, Jacob's family is preserved from the famine by God sending Joseph before them into Egypt. Then in the end of this chapter, we see more of Joseph's dealing during the time of famine. How that all the land is in a famine, and the Egyptians finally run out of money, so they can't pay Pharaoh for the grain anymore. So they end up paying in cattle by giving him all their cattle. Then they give him all their land. Then they give him themselves into their services to Pharaoh. And so by the time the famine is over, Pharaoh owns everything, including the people. He's got the whole land. Whereas before the famine, Pharaohs didn't have quite that much power. The people were under petty tyrants, little petty rulers, and the land was kind of broken up into little, you know, fiefdoms, so to speak. And now Pharaoh has been able to consolidate his power, which will make for a much more efficient and better run government, since Joseph's going to run it now that everybody's under one head, just as again under Christ, all will be under one head again under him in the millennium. And so he typifies Jesus in that. Okay, when we come back Friday, we will pick up with chapter 48.
Excuse me. I missed a class, but then I forgot.
Show me the tape notes. Okay. The 25th?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
What do you think Joseph would fall into that group when he put his liver in a cup? And was it sort of deceiving? Was it